Good afternoon, and welcome to Radio Estina. My name is Alex Linder, and today we're going to talk about things that are relevant to you, the white man, your country, your nation, the world in which you have to live. For those of you who are new, Estina is the opposite of Pravda, which is the noble lie, the big lie, the giant lie, the ideological truth as opposed to the factual reality, which in Russia, in the Russian language, is represented by the word Istina. And the main part of the Istina we're going to cover today comes from the conclusion of the Nameless War by a British captain named Ramsay, R-A-M-S-A-Y, and we're going to finish with his book, The Nameless War, chapters 6 through 12, and then his epilogue. Last time we covered chapters 3 through 6, and we, before that, in earlier Estinas, we talked about 1 to 3, and he discusses the Jewish link. And as one Jew is to say in the 20th century, we stand behind all of the revolutions in your land, not just the Russian, but the French, the English, and the different uprisings that may have not succeeded in becoming full revolutions. The Jew, the radical Jew, supplied by the financial Jew, was behind all of them. And this is a people that has brought endless turmoil to the world in the name of protecting themselves and advancing their ethnic agenda. And just before I got on here, I was taking a look at the latest news, and out of the stories, virtually every one that didn't concern something picayune, but concerned something large, either nationally or internationally, could be traced to some kind of problem created by the Jews. And I'll give a couple examples of those before we get into the main work of the day, which is the Nameless War. What we see in the U.S. this time is an economy that's been globalized, we also see at the same time a loan industry that has fallen apart and is now in the process of being bailed out by Washington. Internationally, we see all kinds of problems in South Africa. And when we look at the people running for president, we see nobody who isn't beholden to the Jewish agenda, the same Jews who created the problems. And we see people who will only offer solutions approved by the Jews, which are, as I've always said, using the pretext created by the problems they've already created as an excuse to step in and offer the full turnkey solution, complete and utter failure, so that when Fannie Mae or Freddie go under, it's presented in the handmade media, who might as well be an official government department themselves, a ministry of truth or enlightenment or propaganda themselves, because all they do is recite Jew-approved stories using Jew-approved terms to advance Jew-approved programs, pushing a Jew-approved agenda set by Jews based on what is good for Jews, and what's good for you, what's good for I, doesn't matter. It's good for me, doesn't matter. What's good for us as whites doesn't matter. The very notion of white identity has been erased very systematically very intentionally, very murderously. They want to deny that whites fall into a class that has interests, interests which are opposed by the interests of the other races. But it's true, and that's the reason they must suppress that idea. They must demonize it. They must stigmatize it. Follow all the rules for radicals as outlined by the Jew Saul Alinsky in the 60s. And no doubt he or his adherents were the type of people who instructed Barack Obama in how to operate politically and shake down whites for the benefit of blacks when he was an organizer in Chicago neighborhoods a couple decades ago. Alinsky's rules for radicals are always stigmatize, isolate, attack, destroy. And that's what they've done to whites as a whole, so that it's difficult to find whites who will identify with their own race, even though it's greatly to their advantage as a collective to have official representation and to have people defending their interests. Otherwise, they get picked apart one by one, and eventually their nations are wrecked. And there are many sites out there dealing with various symptoms of this problem. One symptom is the destruction of families by so-called family courts, or by women agitated to press for divorce from feminist lawyers. And we know that the ideas that are put in all these people's heads originated with Jews, or at least were best advanced by them using their media, the mass media that developed over the last 100 years, the mass newspaper, the cheaply produced 1-2-3 cent newspaper sprung up in abundance in every city in the country, the yellow press, the rise of sensationalism in the service of warmongering that we see today in the news. You know, you've got Ahmadinejad speaking, and I saw just a brief clip on Fox, which is Israeli-owned territory, and whose advocates are almost to a man sellouts to Israel, demonizing Ahmadinejad for no reason other than his looking out for the best interests of the people of Iran. He's not a Democrat, but he was elected. He didn't invent lies to invade another country. He didn't then bomb that country and kill hundreds of thousands or over 1 million people. He didn't create millions of refugees in, say, Canada or the U.S. based on the bombing, based on those lies, based on an agenda put forward behind the scenes by Jews. And Jews enjoy making it appear as though their ethnic agenda is really a universal, benevolent, international humanitarian agenda. It's not. Ahmadinejad did nothing wrong. He is the victim of the lies and perfidy of the Jews and the warmongering of the Jews and their use of the American suckers, dupes, rubes, Fox viewers, but I repeat myself, to carry out their lethal injection of whichever nation they seek to use the syringe on. So while Americans execute an agenda created, conceived by Jews and Israelis for Jews, our country is left open to the third world hordes. And I happened to see a little program last night talking about epidemiology, or the spread of contagion around the world, and asking which would be the next great plague. And they talked about SARS. They talked about avian flu. They talked about, what was it, Ebola, just a bit, as that's the more famous one. They also mentioned Nipah virus. And these viruses spread by vectors of animals to other animals into our food supply, and in the particular case in a heavily populated country called Bangladesh, which is full of what might be called generic brown skins, just low, dusky, squat, not very intelligent mud people in Asia. They like to drink the sap out of a particular tree. It's a date palm. They go out, they attach vats, they cut into the tree, and they collect much as you might collect. I remember when I was in elementary school, their description of collection of syrup sap out of the trees in New England, how they used to do that hundreds of years ago. Well, in much the same way these Bangladeshis are collecting date palm sap and drinking it, but fruit-eating bats also like to drink that sap, and they were contaminating with this new thing called Nipah virus, the date palm sap, thereby infecting humans who were dying at a very high rate in these outbreaks in these little villages and hamlets. And I guess it's taken them quite a deal of research to find out what's actually going on. But although the show portrayed someone, ostensibly a Jew named Epstein, as this heroic researcher willing to risk life and limb to figure out the source of the Nipah virus, or actually he was a veterinarian, what the show doesn't tell you is that the reason that we are open to this kind of thing now is because we have Jews like Epstein running our immigration services. As Jews have taken over our governments through our media, through buying up our media, taking technologies developed by white men like Edison and perfecting them for the demoralization of our country through the spread of pornography, say, or through the spread of political lies leading to wars, say, they have, at the same time, they've taken over those media, taken over academia, and taken over government, and they use all of these to form sort of a seamless propagation machine for their lies. And in white Western country after white Western country, what you find is that there's a Jew heading up the immigration department. And again, don't take my word for it. Go look it up. Who's head of the U.S. immigration now? I can't even tell you. The last I knew, it was a Jew named Doris Meisner, but I don't believe she's in position anymore. She's given away to another one who is probably a Jew, but certainly, if not a Jew, is following the Jewish agenda as established in the U.S. in the 1965 Immigration Reform Act, or just plain Immigration Act, I think it was called. And what that did was reverse a 1924 legislative act, which Jews had protested very heavily at the time. And what the Jews were able to get passed through Emanuel Seller with Teddy Kennedy, drunken Easy Ted Kennedy, as the white face on it, was an act which essentially reversed immigration to the U.S. from being almost totally European in order to preserve the stock of people already in the country, primarily from Northern and Western Europe, to a third world policy in which more than 9 out of every 10 people legally admitted to the U.S. would come from the third world, places just like Bangladesh, where people are infected with SARS, with AIDS, with Nipah virus, with Ebola, with Hantavirus, can come here legally and spread their multiple drug-resistant tuberculosis to our natives. Because you see, the end goal here is a one-world state without any distinct races. And the means to achieve that end are using government, media, and academia to spread lies about the desirability of race mixing. And that is why everything that you see in the media encourages white females to mix with non-white males. This will raise the average mentality of the resulting mulatto from what the black average would be. It will somewhat temper their violence, but it will destroy the white genes utterly. Our concern That's the real meaning of once you go black, you never go back. You've incorporated into your bloodline something that is more violent, more savage, and simply lacks the capacity for civilization that whites have. And that's why Jews want to destroy us as a race, because we present a threat to them. We have a different and more beautiful way of living than they do. The Jewish way can be seen, if you've ever seen the show Seinfeld or Curb Your Enthusiasm, by the guy who created Seinfeld, a Jew named Larry David, in which you see that Jews are bickering, nattering, disingenuous people, and they're obsessed with minutiae. They pay attention to details. They suspect motives. They doubt everybody. And they have what Mencken at one point called a libido for the ugly, although he was not referring to Jews when he said it, but to American architecture and something in the American soul that seemed to respond to ugliness, he felt at the time. And perhaps it was simply early capitalism, that people didn't have enough money or knowledge to build great buildings, or they just couldn't afford it. But whatever the case, Jews seem to have an inherent biological love of messing things up, of spoiling things, destroying anything that they can't create. They're very vengeful people. And their ultimate act of vengeance, and if you doubt that they're vengeful people, it means that you don't know their history. You don't even know their holidays, which are based on their genocide of other races they came in contact with. Now, whether their stories are true or not, it shows you their thinking. It's an accurate reflection of their mentality. And so what the Jews desire to do in their ultimate success would be mixing every other race out of existence but their own, leaving them in the possession of the entire world with the ability to rule the world for their own advantage for all time to come. And that, believe it or not, is what they seek. And they have the media power. They have the media power to make their ideas seem plausible and to present themselves to humanity as its savior, much as they promote their own Jonas Salk. He cured polio. It's funny, many diseases have been cured or eradicated, but the one disease that's been helped along that Jews have helped cure, and Salk was not alone, he headed a team, and the primary research done by his team was not done by him or any other Jew, it was done by a team of Aryans that he put his name at the head of. No other disease is attributed, no other disease's solution or eradication is attributed to any religion, just polio. And it's funny, it's very useful in Jews in trotting that out. Oh, if it weren't for Jews, we wouldn't have a cure for polio. Do Jews credit Christians for eradicating every other disease, or do they credit white men or Aryans for inventing all the technologies they use to oppress us? Of course they don't. There's nothing fair about it. Life's not fair, as John F. Kennedy used to say. And so we must beware of what the Jews are trying to do to us and seek our ultimate liberation, which comes through the complete segregation from, indeed, the eradication of Jews themselves. And whites have to use their intelligence to understand how they are being manipulated and to what end, and to take steps against it. And you won't achieve that understanding by following the mass media, which are, in fact, owned by Jews. We've talked before, there are three schools of thought, but only two are formally recognized in the controlled media. And what the Jews do, just as they use two parties to confuse you as to the actuality of one-party control of our politics, they use two parties in the media to persuade you that there are genuine differences of opinion between, say, MSNBC and Fox News. In fact, there are not. The things they agree on are more important than the true debate they allow, because the true debate they allow, the real debate they allow, is within a very tiny portion of the spectrum. so that you're not allowed to have any deep disagreement over the fundamentals of the new system as effectively put in place by the Jews in the 60s as the result of their communist revolution. And what they did in the 60s was achieve all of the goals they had sought, or most of the goals they had sought, since they first came to America in appreciable numbers after 1890. And even by the 1924 Act that I mentioned, which was a result of having more open borders, Congress went ahead and decided to limit newcomers to their stocks already within the country as a means of preserving its character and its basis. Jews protested that and denounced nativism, and the word racism hadn't been coined yet. It was to be coined, actually it was coined right around the time of those debates, apparently by Leon Trotsky or one of his acolytes, and it was promoted in a book that first appeared in German by a Magnus Hirschfeld, who was a Jew in Germany, just as Trotsky was a Jew in Russia, where they had already achieved a successful revolution. Hirschfeld was a Jew pushing deviant sex. He was operating on that front. There are many ways to destroy a nation. Two of the good ones are by demoralizing it, that is, destroying its morals through the spreading of pornography and the depiction of that spread as the spread of free speech, that is, Jews like to portray pornography, mass availability, and the girls gone wild culture as something inherently liberating, freeing, improving things, getting rid of the repression of the past. But their real agenda is to destroy anti-Semitism, which in their minds is bound up with sexual continence, believe it or not. And in fact, it's probably true, because those who think and who consider what they do and who control their sexual behavior are going to be more prone to seeing the Jews for what they are: nation wreckers, as the Romans called them, the common enemy of humanity. As even one of the French revolutionaries, Voltaire, said, "I would not be surprised if one day this people becomes the enemy of the entire earth." And that's exactly what has happened. Now, just running down the news that we see here, we see in South Africa, again, we're doing this before we turn to the Nameless War, we see that in South Africa, the Negroes are having a fallout. The forces behind Mbeki and the opposition, 11 South African ministers have resigned. And again, what's worth telling you and what's worth knowing is that you see how all of this is linked. That's the crucial thing here. You understand that South Africa, like Zimbabwe, used to be a state which was in the hands of whites, because whites, after all, had built South Africa from the ground up. Before whites arrived in the 1600s, the Boer folk arrived, the German, Dutch, French farmers or bauer peasants arrived and built the state. There wasn't anything out there but a bunch of Hottentots running around in the desert, and maybe a Negro here and there coming down from the center of the continent. Once the Dutch in South Africa and the English in Rhodesia had built their states into first world nations, pretty much the only such on the African continent, they became attractive to blacks, who were essentially, in the words of that old rap song, or that song, I forget who sung it, pigeons. The blacks came around as pigeons seeking free food, shelter, jobs, and the usufructs of white civilization, such as indoor plumbing, that they could not achieve or build, they couldn't even sustain, as we're seeing now, on their own. So whites go to Africa, and in some cases they colonize it, but in other cases, in the case of South Africa, it truly wasn't colonization. It was building from nothing. There were very, very few people around, and they were essentially brush savages. You know, humans who are more feral are essentially part of the wildlife more than they are humans in the true European sense. The whites build these civilizations from ground up, all the way to including nuclear power, and at the time of its downfall, South Africa was virtually an autarky. It was in the top 10 of virtually every major mineral and chemical that you can find. It had incredible natural resources. The only thing that South Africa ever lacked that it didn't have locally in its own under its own ground, in its own rocks, was oil. And after decades of hostility from the Jew-controlled international press, South Africa knew that it was under attack from sanctions, as Rhodesia had been before it was destroyed, before Ian Smith yielded power to the black thug Mugabe. South Africa knew that it had to maintain stocks of oil, and it had a 2 to 3 year supply itself. And an autarky means you're self-sufficient. And that's what you need if you're beset by sanctions. And South Africa was beset by sanctions, much as we're going to hear about Germany being beset by sanctions in World War II, as the Jews moved to destroy it because it was taking itself out of the international usury system that they relied on to produce the money that they used to buy other politicians. Or, you know, more directly in the case of George Soros, to affect the changes they needed themselves. That requires a lot of money. They had it, and they got that money by tax farming the locals in exchange for benefits from the king, as they used to do in the olden days that we've heard about from the E. Michael Jones books. But more recently, they own these large banks, Goldman Sachs, Kuhn Loeb, etc., and they use the incredible amount of money that they make speculating to consolidate their political power. And if they speculate wrongly or badly, and they attempt to go bust, then we see what else we see in the news today, which is banks going under, except they end up being bailed out by the Jews' connections in Washington. You've heard the phrase privatized profits, socialized costs. That's exactly what this is. These billionaires are gambling with their money to make additional billions. But if they lose their bets, if they bet on a currency going the wrong way or a stock going the wrong way, and they do it on a large enough scale, their losses are large enough to make them actually on the verge of going under. Why they turn to their politicians to bail them out? And who pays for all that? Well, we do. What the Jews then do is get Washington to bail them out, and this is done through the office of the printing press, which simply prints fresh sheets of paper, stamps them out as $100 bills, and gives that back out to the banks, thereby diluting the money supply, making each individual dollar worth less. And that's why when you go to the store today in Kirksville, Missouri, you can buy baking potatoes for $1 a piece, up from 88 cents earlier this year, up from 2 for $1 within the last year. That's 50% inflation on potatoes within the last year, as best I can recall. And I've got a little homemade CPI, Consumer Price Index, at vnnforum.com. which I encourage you to join. And we see that in Finland, there's just been a shooting of gunman kills 10 people at his trade school in Western Finland. Why is this? I don't know. But one reason that people are unhappy and you see things like school shootings is that the agenda being foisted on them by the Jews doesn't serve their true interests. And they may not have the intellectual understanding of why that is, that shows like this provide, but they sense it nonetheless. They sense that things are not set up for what is truly good for them, what they truly need, as opposed to what they might temporarily want. They suspect that in all the teachings about diversity and multiculturalism, there's no future for a white man. He's just reduced to the status of a butt bearing a burden. That is, a butt, the figure of ridicule, the laughing stock, the sucker who's just there to pay the bills for the all-knowing woman, as the Jews try to split sex from sex, and the third worlder, that the Jews' falsified version of history, he is told to make amends for by his public school teachers. And, oh, this happened in Finland. Well, in Finland they have the same thing. They have an elite that is made up of Jews and traitors whose goal is to bring in millions of Africans and Asians, non-whites, who will dilute the genetic stock of the blondest people on earth, because that is good for Jews. Wrecking nations is what Jews do. And if this Nipah virus show demonstrated one thing, it's that viruses and parasites are found everywhere in nature. So why wouldn't humans have viruses and parasites? And why wouldn't these viruses and parasites, often the way that they make their way in the world, is by simulating or duplicating or themselves, or pretending to be something that they're not, but they appear very similar to, as a viceroy butterfly appears similar to a monarch, in order not to get eaten, because birds know that things colored like monarchs don't taste good, so viceroys apparently have evolved a similar coloring in order to steal that advantage, whether or not they, while they actually may taste good themselves. And so we see across the Western world that was created by whites. It wasn't created by the Catholic Church, it was created by white men. And that's the essential thing, regardless of what the Catholics say. Wherever whites have gone, no matter if they embraced the false religion as the English did or the Dutch, and those were centers of Protestant upheaval and operations against the Pope and the Catholic social order, as Jones denounced, and those were centers for Jews fleeing from the Inquisition. They ran to the Amsterdam and the Netherlands. They ran to England. They helped put the bad guys back on the throne in England and let the Jews back into England. No matter if people of this, what Jones would say, false social order, people with this false background, it didn't matter, because when they went to Africa and founded Rhodesia, it was a complete success, even though there probably wasn't a single Catholic within Rhodesia. I could be wrong, but my guess is they were all Anglicans or other British Protestants, and yet they still created a stable, functioning society. Whereas black Catholics, black Asians, haven't achieved anything commensurate with what white Catholics have. That's because the blood matters more than the sacraments. Yeah. Now, okay, just one little more quick review of the news, and then we'll go on to discuss the Nameless War. And just what I'm seeing here is, as you go through the news, we've got Congress bailing out large failing Jewish investment banks. They take all the risks, right? The Jewish government and media working together force sometimes even their own banks to make bad loans to minorities. They blame the historically racist practice of redlining, that is, not offering policies in certain areas. They say that's racist. They force some of these banks to go in and make bad loans to minorities. That is, banks have developed over the centuries criteria for creditworthiness. And yet the Jews, through their media and through their politicians, have forced the bank to go against their own lending principles in order to reap various political advantages of helping these minorities to what they're not entitled to, what they don't deserve. And again, we get politics intruding into the market and distorting it. And as always, the money flows from the white to the colored, or from the white and to the Jew. And so, ultimately, what's going on here is the penalization. They're penalizing any white who is cautious, sober, careful. Everything that they denounce when they use the term conservative as either cowardly or stupid. And it's always used as a negative term. And so the whites of the type and mindset who built the country are being penalized by seeing their savings eroded through inflation. But the Jews had best remember that what led to Hitler's successful revolution in Germany was precisely what the Jews are doing now. Inflation. It's not at the same level yet, but what the Jews have done in the U.S. is put themselves in a situation where they're wiping out middle-class savings through inflation. It just simply isn't high enough to create a revolt in the streets yet. But we see, okay, we see banks being bailed out. We see the economy being shipped abroad to China and the third world, replaced by a service economy. We see school shootings. We see the disintegration of countries destroyed by the Jewish media, which encouraged them and levied all sanction against them to turn over political power to the new black majority, even though blacks had nothing to do with creating the states of Rhodesia and South Africa. We see now that those countries can't run themselves, and that whites are effectively being warred on, and that the rapes and the murders carried out by these blacks, who've been taught by the Jews through school and government and media to hate whites, are not even reported by the same Jews who were making an endless saga out of maybe a dozen blacks being shot for rioting 35 years ago. Now, we also see here's another story. This is being reported by Fox. Fifth grader suspended for wearing anti-Obama shirt. So again, we have the rest of the news is that we have a presidential debate between a Marxist mulatto who wasn't even born in the U.S. and is legally unqualified to be president because they falsified his birth certificate in order to claim that he was born in Hawaii. We have a debate between him and between an utter warmonger who has sold his soul to Zion in order to further the Jewish agenda and achieve personal power for himself. And he puts his personal interest ahead of the interests of his own nation and his own people. And these are the two who are competing to become the next president. But what's good for whites isn't represented by anybody, and whites have no candidate in the race. A white presidential candidate would act quite differently from McCain or Obama. A white candidate would say, we are going to end aid to Israel. We are going to let Israel make it on its own, thereby saving billions of dollars a year. We are going to prevent the Jews from stealing our technology and selling it to China, selling nuclear technology even to Pakistan and some of these unstable states. We are going to rid the White House and the Congress of all dual citizens and anybody of Jewish ancestry. We're going to get them out of the country. They have their Israel. Let them go to it. we are going to bring our troops home from Iraq. We are going to reposition them on the border with Mexico. We are going to revise the 1965 Immigration Act to exclude non-whites. We are going to round up all the people who have come here in the last 30 years from the Third World, and we are going to deport them in a new Operation Wetback. This is the way that someone who is genuinely pro-white would talk. We are going to end affirmative action. We are going to bring back the constitutional principle of free association, allow people to hire and fire and rent to whom they want for whatever reason they want, because that is freedom and that is the white cultural way. And these kikes need to be taught cultural competency when it comes to the white man. The same cultural competency they demand for blacks and Mexicans and Asians and every other group they've allowed in here that didn't used to be here. That's how a white candidate would speak. But of course you're not going to hear that, because there is no white candidate. There are only Jew front candidates, white faces on a Jewish agenda. And Obama may push the domestic social welfare side harder and faster, while McCain may push the international warmongering, make the world safe for Israel agenda faster, but neither of them is advocating what's good for white Americans, to be redundant. And I use American as an example because I'm an American, but, and I know our history better, but you find precisely the same background forces and agenda at work in all of the white Western countries, whether it's Australia, New Zealand, Rhodesia, South Africa, or whether it's in Europe itself. The same Jews are following the same tactics, buying up the same media, and pushing the same global message in every one of these Western countries. And all of this is aimed at the genocide of our race. That's the ultimate end of all of this stuff. We saw the other week, the end of the South was a Newsweek cover. They're celebrating what they take to be the end of a type of people and a type of gene that they hate. They want to see it destroyed. They mock it routinely on their TV, even while they accuse us of being genocidal and killing all these Jews and being anti-Semitic. They are the real haters. They are the real genocidalists. Okay, now let's play a couple of songs, and then we will go to the Nameless War and finish up with that. I'm going to play 3 songs here.
Just
We're back. That was Push and Shove by Fatboy Slim. Before that, we heard the first of three, Alphaville by... Summer in Berlin by Alphaville. And then in the middle, we heard Punk Rock Girl by Dead Milkmen. So, three songs will wrap up that little set. And now we'll return and we'll discuss The Nameless War by Captain A.H.M. Archibald Maul Ramsay, educated at Eton and Royal Military College Sandhurst, wounded in the First World War, and someone who came to understand the Jewish taproot of the various revolutionary flowers that sprang up in Europe over the last 1,000 years. And we've come at that Jew root from many different angles. I'm always reminded of that quotation from, I think, Thoreau, that for everyone hacking at the root of evil, there are thousands hacking at the branches. Well, the root of this stuff is Jews, and Jews pursuing their agenda, and that agenda being 180 degrees from what is good for whites. The only thing that matters to the Jews who provide your government, your media, and the agenda carried out in the textbooks given to your children is what is good for Jews, and all history must be rewritten in that light. Thus, all history becomes lies dedicated to advancing the Jewish agenda, which is anti-white. And only whites working together as whites can change this state of affairs. The hour is late. What we're going to hear about now are the Jews' reaction to Hitler's coming to power in Germany and his determination to not only take political control away from the Jews by taking the government from them, the Weimar democracy that was so hated in Germany, by taking the media away from them, and by removing Germany from the international money system. This prevented the gravest threat Judaism had perhaps ever faced, because you'll remember from earlier Radio Astinas when we discussed the Catholic position towards Jews, which came known as Psychic Judaeus Known. I'm probably butchering that, but those are the three words that in Latin were the basis of the Church's policy towards Jews, which is basically, as long as they don't subvert our faith and morals and our culture, they're allowed to go their own way and must not be molested, which is tantamount to saying, as long as the Jews refrain from being Jews, they're free to be Jews. But again, this is not a church that ponders deeply on things beyond the sacraments, and according to E. Michael Jones, you're undermining faith in the efficacy of the sacraments by claiming that it takes more to change a Jew into a human than a few drops of holy water. And as Jones never tires of reiterating, perhaps not realizing how dumb it makes him and his church sound, the masses of people that were often pursuing a Jew one minute would stop pursuing this Jew the second that he accepted baptism into Christianity. You'll take a check? I thought you wanted real money. You know, that's how you have to look at that. And that's why the church has been subverted successfully today. Whether Jones understands it or not, we aren't trapped by his limits. We are free to look outside of the doctrines promulgated by his church to find the real factual istina, the truth reflected in reality. The reality is that the Jew is biologically different from the Aryan. And the Jew is not a pure race. It has mixtures of Asian, African, and European. But the Jew maintained its own breeding populations in Europe. And what you often find is that the hardcore, the conservative, the Orthodox pump out the majority of new Jewish pups. And the lesser Orthodox tend to go out into the Goyish community and intermarry with their elite. And this over time tends to... it tends to confuse things, and it makes it easier for them to control the host population. But the Catholic Church isn't interested in biology since it maintains the fiction that we are all spiritual brothers and we're all one. All that is necessary is that we accept the one true church. But now, Hitler, who was raised a Catholic and originally was against anti-Semitism until he went to Vienna, and we saw last show, I think this is show 27, we saw last show that Ramsey used a number of quotations from Hitler taken from Mein Kampf to show how Hitler's view of the Jews evolved from his view that anti-Semitism was a bad thing to his understanding that Jews were behind the social democratic press, that Jews were the source of Marxism, that all of this was inherently meaningless except for the fact that it showed how one race of people was doing battle with another, but it was doing it in a thousand forms and hidden behind a thousand facades. And that once you understood the Jewish root of all these lies that were ripping his world apart, you understood how to fight against them and that you had to take a stand against the Jews and their clever words. And the Jews were doing in Germany, in German lands, what they do today in Anglophone lands, that is the English-speaking world. They were perverting the morals. They were spreading the Girls Gone Wild culture. And they were denouncing racialism or nationalism. Because a nation that sticks together can't be undermined by the Jews as easily as an atomized nation of porn-seeking individualists. And that's why all of Jew humor, seen through the roasts on Comedy Central, perhaps in its clearest, dirtiest form in the roast, but visible everywhere that the Jew touches the mass media, is the low laugh and the love of pornography and degradation and low sex puerility. That is the common theme running through everything that Jews touch. If you see something beautiful or noble or not animalistically inclined to the Aryan, well, you know that an Aryan created it. If you see something that is inherently dirty, you know that it came from a Jew. Aryans deal with the same matter that Jews do, and sometimes in a superficially similar way, as in Rabelais dealing with, you know, having his character wipe his ass on 50 different things to find out which is softest. Aryans deal with that, but they don't deal with the dirty stuff in a dirty way the way the Jews do. With the Jews, it always has the character of more of a fetish, but it's a fetish with a particular political motive behind it. It's a fetish pushing an ethnic agenda of demoralizing our kind. For our kind, sex and that stuff is one aspect of life, an important one. But sex and shit and the relation between them and endlessly harping on it and talking about it and making a fetish of it or a god of it, that's what Jews do to inflame and infantilize us, to destroy white families by promoting homosexuality, so that if you go out in the street to protest what the niggers they loosed have done to our women, as we saw in Knoxville, they beat you down, throw you in jail. But if you go out in the streets to fellate your fellow man, why, they don't beat you down. They let the public in to mix with you, and they protect you as you sodomize gaily through the streets. So that shows you what Jews really think about things. Homosexuality is good for the Jews. Girls Gone Wild, irresponsibility, and 40-year-old players, as depicted in Bud Light ads, these are good for the Jews. They're what you see on TV, which is mass schooling for those, you know, of school age and beyond. That's where it's sort of the national intercom. That's where the principal tells you what to do. And as a white writer said, I think it was, oh gosh, can't remember, it was an English writer, and I can't recall his name right at the moment. He was of a family of writers. But what he said was that they'll take your political freedom, and in exchange they'll give you sexual license. And he said that probably 100 years ago. And that is precisely what the Jews have done. They've taken all the adult decisions away from the grown Aryan men, and they've created sort of what in Britain would be a lad culture, or yobs, or just men who are insubstantial and can't raise families, or don't, or never form families in the first place, and are dedicated to nothing but hedonism. And this culture is promoted on TV, and it's promoted in the various men's magazines. I don't mean the pornographic ones, but Playboy or Maxim or any of the numerous others that sprang up in the 90s. And by the same token, the Jew works at it from every angle. So he works at it not just from the angle of infantilizing the male population or homosexualizing it, but also from the other standpoint of pushing women to take careers where they won't raise children because they'll never even have children. And getting the women through various laws, they're going to promote women and minorities, and they always use that term, to promote the idea, just as they do through interracial porn, that they naturally belong together and are naturally at war with the white male, notice, rather than the white man. They don't like to say white man. They like to say white male because it's more disrespectful and dismissive. They change the laws so that through what they call another euphemism, what is racial discrimination and sexual discrimination, they call affirmative action, in order to subsidize and privilege white females and coloreds over white men in order to take power away from them. And then they mock those same white men in their media in a thousand different ways. And they find sellouts who are willing to play along, like Larry the Cable Guy or Jeff Foxworthy, who are willing to mock their own region, their own type of people, very much in the style of Amos and Andy. The Jews are always playing one group of people against another. Divide and conquer is the way they play it, not just between nations, but within nations, setting class against class, setting race against race, sharpening and inflaming racial differences, whereas the white man and the black man worked out a way of getting along through Jim Crow and segregation. The Jew is there to force them to mix. Whether the Jew is left-wing or right-wing, those don't mean anything next to the fact of his being a Jew. And he pushes them together to serve his own goals, as we've discussed on earlier Radio Astinas, where we talked about how the Jews thwarted Marcus Garvey and his school of black nationalism that would have led blacks back to Africa, would have had them develop parallel, separate social institutions in their own community, but the Jews needed the blacks to be forcibly integrated with the whites. So every separate class of people is to the Jew a tool that he can use to achieve his own empowerment and enthronement for all times. And Jews are indeed, as the Romans said, the common enemy of all humanity. And the proper policy toward them is not to talk to them, it's to kill them. To exterminate them is what is needed to happen to the Jews in order to protect white interests. They are doing the same thing to us. They just don't call it that. They don't speak that baldly about their aims, except in their private publications, which they know that the mass of Goyim will never be exposed to or hear about. In those, they're happy to say, yeah, we're mixing the races in order to murder the whites. We hate white people. We aren't white. We don't consider ourselves white. They're so brazen nowadays, they make that clear even in some of their entertainment. You see their attitude is always up with the black, down with the white. They hate all of our institutions. They hate our kind, but they seek to use us en route to destroying us for all times. That's their motive and their agenda. Now let's turn to the Nameless War. Chapter 6, 1933, Jewry declares war. Says Ramsey, the English edition of Mein Kampf, My Struggle, originally entitled My Struggle Against 12 Years of Lies, Stupidity, and Cowardice, shortened to Mein Kampf, My Struggle, by Hitler, was still in the process of printing and publication when Jewry declared war on the National Socialist regime and started an intensive blockade against Germany. Now, you may remember that there was a blockade against Germany after World War I, so about 12 years before the time that Ramsey is describing, the blockade was kept up after World War I, and many Germans starved to death. And so Germany was really very cruelly persecuted and mistreated, and that's as much the story of the 20th century as anything, but the Jews go a long way to ensuring that you see them, you see Jews as victims. And every year they have a story about some high school or junior high class in the hinterland America and how it's collecting paper clips or it's doing something to honor the Holocaust and the victims. And there's always some Holocaust survivor who pops up in one of these rural areas and is treated as a god. It really is like the whites are a captive population of these Jews and their lies. And all of these so-called survivors are in time revealed to be frauds. They're brought before, you know, these audiences at the libraries and the public schools. But always in the end, these people are nothing more than liars and fraudsters. All that happened in World War II was whites took away power from Jews in Germany, and they threatened, through the German military expansion, to take power away from Jews throughout Europe. And rather than killing Jews, all they did was force them to emigrate, as you can see from the reports of Jews who were actually alive at the time. But instead of admitting that truth, Jews spread the lie that 6 million of them had been gassed to death by the Germans. That was an Allied communist propaganda item with the number selected because it fits with Jewish Kabbalah. Six is apparently a big figure in Kabbalah lore, and I refer you to Michael Hoffman if you want to learn more about that. Or E. Michael Jones, he also has quite a deal about that, which we have not discussed on Radio Astina. But the point is, for propaganda purposes, they settled upon the lie of the 6 million being murdered by Germans, and thus, by repeating that endlessly, they ingrained it in people's minds as a fact, even though it's nothing more than a repetition of a manufactured legend. But the facts about World War II, and we will get into this in successive shows, and what was done to the Germans are truly horrifying things to behold. And there are a couple good books talking about it. One is A Terrible Revenge by a guy named Zayas, Z-A-Y-A-S, D-E, new word, Z-A-Y-A-S, wrote about what happened in Germany. There's another book by, I believe, named Father Keeling that also talks about that. We'll get into that in future shows once we're done with the Nameless War. And what these are books that I acquired a couple of years ago. They're books that tell the truth about what happened in the 20th century. Hence, they are books that are very difficult or costly to obtain. Although, thanks to the rise of online booksellers, some of these books are now more easily and cheaply attainable than they ever were before, certainly before the rise of the Internet. And we have to use the latest white man's technology, the Internet, to ensure that it serves our white agenda rather than the Jew agenda. And, of course, Obama is happily in line with the Jewish agenda of shutting down all criticism and factual history as hate speech. And if he is elected, he will no doubt sign off on whatever legislation the Jews put forward. And they put it forward a number of times, but Bush rejected it only because, most likely, it had stuff advancing the homosexual agenda, which he's still opposed to. I don't know, McCain might support hate speech controls also. Already across the Western world, we have all kinds of men in jail where this type of law obtains. Two of those men are from Britain who are in jail out in Santa Ana, California today because of simple opinion pieces they published on a computer, a server located in the U.S. The words they published would have been illegal to be published in Britain. And the British went into their houses, arrested them, and jailed them. And these are the authors at heretical.com, Simon Shepherd and Luke O'Farrell, or Stephen Whittle is his real name. Luke O'Farrell is his pen name, and they are now in jail in California awaiting an asylum hearing. They requested political asylum in the U.S. because there is no First Amendment in Britain, and anything that exposes minorities to hostility, contempt, even including the factual truth, is illegal there. And that's what the Jewish tyranny in England uses in order to maintain its power there. Throw anybody in jail who criticizes you or points out what you're doing. And the Jews would like that same law for the United States. And with McCain or Obama coming to power, they might get it. So Ramsey says that in 33, the English edition of Mein Kampf was still being printed when Jewry declared war on the Nazis and started an intensive blockade against Germany. The International Jewish Boycott Conference was assembled in Holland in the summer of 1933 under the presidency of Mr. Samuel Untermeyer of the USA, who was elected president of the World Jewish Economic Federation, formed to combat the opposition to Jews in Germany. So Hitler takes power in January of 33. By the summer, the Jews have a boycott conference in Holland, and the president, Samuel Untermeyer from the U.S., is appointed or elected head of the president of the World Jewish Economic Federation. On his return to the U.S., Mr. Untermeyer gave an address over the station WABC, the text of which is printed in the New York Times of August 7, 1933, I have before me. Mr. Untermeyer referred in the opening phrases to, quote, "the holy war and the cause of humanity in which we are embarked." So see, Jews always, as I've said, they masquerade their own ethnic agenda under the cover of something that's universal to humanity. When Jews are attacked, how often do you hear in neocon writing, and the sellouts and apologists who cover for them, oh, Jews are the canary in the coal mine. What first happens in the Jewish community then affects everybody else. This is not true, though. The Jews were legally worked against in Germany by the Nazis because they were fomenting communist revolution. And it wasn't an attack on humanity. It was a response to attack by Jews on Germany that the German nationalists were responding to. So Jews always lie about their agenda, and they lie about the reason people are hostile to them, namely it's the natural result of their own behavior. And they are never willing to have their behavior considered, because to the extent their behavior is considered, it will be found to be highly dangerous to the host people they live among. They prefer to dismiss it as anti-Semitism and claim that it's an inherently defective part of the entire rest of the world, since they've received the same reaction wherever they've gone because they behave the same way, rather than confront their own behavior. And you can see why people have always called Jews vermin and parasites, because their behavior is so analogous to the behavior of parasites and viruses in the rest of the world. So the Nazis come to power in Germany in 1933 in January, and by that summer the Jews are forming up a worldwide boycott conference in Holland, and they elect an American Jew named Untermeyer the head of it, and the New York Times, a Jewish paper, a Jew-owned paper by this point for decades, allows a Jew to make their case in its pages. And remember, this is the number one American paper. And he's claiming that rather than Jews simply fighting for their own advantage and privilege, the Jewish war against the Nazis represents the holy war and the cause of humanity. And says Ramsey, he proceeded to develop the subject at great length, describing the Jews as the aristocrats of the world. Each of you, this is a quote from Untermeyer's article in the New York Times in August 1933, 6 months after the Nazis have taken power, or 7 months. Each of you, Jew and Gentile alike, who is not already enlisted in this sacred war, should do so now and here. So this is a holy war on behalf of humanity that the Jews are claiming they are undertaking against the Nazis. Those Jews who did not join in, he denounced, declaring they are traitors to their race. In January 1934, Mr. Jabotinsky, founder of Revisionist Zionism, wrote in Nacha Rech, which I assume is a Russian paper, quote, "The fight against Germany has been carried out for months by every Jewish community, conference, trade organization, by every Jew in the world. We shall let loose a spiritual and material war of the whole world against Germany." So remember, here are a bunch of Jews claiming that Every Jew around the world is effectively fighting, or as many as can be got to, certainly every community taken generally, is fighting against what Germany is doing to the Jews as a way to protect the German people, the German subset of the Aryan people, against the Jew, his natural enemy. So whites have retaken power in one of their countries, and the alarm goes up worldwide. Oh my God, we've got to regain control of Germany and put it back in the hands of the Jew. That's what Jews are really concerned about. And they have to lie, because they're such a small percentage of the population, to the host people that they are under attack, when in fact it's the Jews themselves who are under attack. Germany wasn't threatening anybody else. Just the Jews who had taken control of Germany, and the Jews who had fomented these communist revolutions and uprisings in Eastern Europe. Says Ramsey, this is perhaps the most confident assertion extant on the Jewish claim set out in the Protocols of Zion that they can bring about war. So what Ramsey has done here is show that 1933, the Germans retake power in Germany from the Jews, and an alarm goes up worldwide, and he has quoted, you know, the American capitalist side and the Russian communist side, both saying that Jews must fight a universal war on behalf of humanity. Humanity, this is an anti-human problem, to destroy the Germans in Germany. Jews presenting their ethnic-specific agenda as universally desirable and benevolent. As Jews always do, they advance their social agenda as though it were objective science. See, so you recognize the Jewish approach. And Ramsey is pointing out the parallel. He's saying this is the most direct and confident assertion of what the Jews say in the protocols, which is that they can bring about war. And yet when you say Jews control the media, they say you're a conspiracy theorist. That's their term that they intend to be used by the dupes and suckers who carry water for them to use against the people who truly understand them, as proven by their own statements under duress. When the Jews under duress, he speaks officially, yeah, we can bring about war and we will. Just as the Balfour letter, Weizmann said, yeah, we'll bring America into World War I, in exchange you give us Palestine. So the Jews are asserting that they can bring about war, as outlined in the Protocols of Zion. Protocol number 7 states, quote, we must be in position to respond to every act of opposition by a state by war with its neighbor. If these should venture to stand collectively, by universal war. So they have to be ready to attack anybody who understands what they're doing and fights back. It should be remembered here that a copy of these protocols was filed in the British Museum in 1906, says Ramsey. By 1938, the Jewish war was in full swing, and already through their influence or pressure, many Gentile persons and groups were being drawn into the vortex. Various members of the British Socialist Party were openly advocating joining in this Cold War, and a vigorous and uncompromising clique was growing in all parties under the leadership of Messrs. Churchill, Amory, Duff Cooper, and others. Quote, Hitler will have no war, but he will be forced to it, not this year, but later on, unquote, screamed the Jew Emil Ludwig in the June copy of Les Annales, 1934. So, in 1934, the Jews are saying that Hitler will be forced to war. Remember, Hitler did not. It has been Ramsey's task to demonstrate that Hitler was not at war with the British Empire. He admired it as he admired the Catholic Church and wished to preserve it. What he wanted was to reach an agreement allowing him to stomp out, to give him a free hand to stomp out Jew Bolshevism in the East. And of course, the Jews are, just as they misrepresent their own agenda, they're going to misrepresent Hitler. So instead of being a sane, rational person, he becomes a madman. And instead of someone who wants to keep Germany for Germans and de-Judaize it because it's good for the German people, they present him as wanting to take over the world in order to co-opt and dupe the Gentiles into fighting their war for them. He's not at war with Jews. He's at war with France and England and the U.S. and Russia and everywhere. And so we're going to drag him into war in order to destroy him, is their goal. Just as today they're trying to demonize Ahmadinejad and drag him into a war to destroy him, because he and his kind understand what Jews are and how evil they are and how they are against the interests of the average Muslim and Iranian and Iraqi, just as they are against the interests of the average American and German and Frenchman and Briton. And the Jews are using the same techniques today to demonize anybody who stands up to them and claim to the American sapsucker that he's really at war with you and he's a terrorist and all this. And since they control the high ground, the media, satellite uplinks, they are generally getting away with it. On June 3rd, 1938, matters were carried a long step further by an article in the American Hebrew, the weekly organ of American Jewry. This article, which opened by showing that Hitler never deviated from his Mein Kampf doctrine, went on to threaten the direst retaliation. Quote, "It has become patent that a combination of Britain, France, and Russia will sooner or later bar the triumphant march of Hitler. Either by accident or design," italics Ramses, "a Jew has come to position of foremost importance in each of these nations. In the hands of non-Aryans lies the fate of the very lives of millions. In France, the Jew of prominence is Leon Blum. Leon Blum may yet be the Moses who will lead. Maxim Litvinov, Soviet super salesman, is a Jew who sits at the right hand of Stalin. The English Jew of prominence is Leslie Hore Belisha, Horebelisha. Tommy Atkins is new boss." So the Jews in their own internal publication before World War II are pointing out that they have, that Jews, either by accident or by design, have been brought to the highest positions of prominence in each of the nations they're going to need to trick into war in order to destroy Hitler, who has reclaimed Germany for the Aryan, for the white man, for the German. Later in this article we read, "So it may come to pass that these three sons of Israel," that's Leon Blum in France, Litvinov in Russia, and Hore Belisha in England, "will form the combine that will send the frenzied Nazi dictator to hell. And when the smoke of battle clears, and the man who played the swastika Christus is lowered into a hole in the ground, as the trio of non-Aryans intone a ramified requiem, a medley of the Marseillaise, God Save the King, and the Internationale, blending with a proud and aggressive rendering of Eli Eli," which I suppose is some Jew song. And note how they are saying that, you know, they're going to sing the French national song, the English national song, and the Jews' international song, the Internationale, after Russia, Britain, and France have destroyed Hitler. They will have taken revenge on yet another enemy who figured out what they were up to and stopped them, at least in a space, and at least for a time. And that was what they said in 1938 did in fact come to pass, with the addition of America being brought in to finish the job. And as a result today, all white Western lands lie under the heel of the international Jew, and all of them have the new form of communism imposed upon them: multiculturalism, diversity, sexual puerility, looseness, promiscuity, demoralization, all of this imposed from above and outside upon them. And most of them can't even make it out, because it's been going on, this process, for so many decades and through so many institutional forms. Not just the government and the public schools and the colleges and the media, but through the pulpit itself, through their own, they believe, religion, as their religious leaders, from Jerry Falwell to Pat Robertson to John Hagee to the Pope himself, are bought off, either with direct payments through meals, flights to Israel, gifts of planes, or through fear, and through manipulation, and through subversion, as was the case and bore fruition, came to fruition in Vatican II, through the seminaries, as cardinals who used to be Jews or were operating with them overthrew the Church's traditional policy towards Jews and pushed the popes in the way of liberalizing first on the Jewish issue. They haven't got them completely to come around on the sexual issue, which is why the Church of Rome remains a butt and a laughingstock and a subject of ridicule for Jews on the mass media. Anything that works even indirectly in favor of the people the Jews need to control will become the subject of lawsuits and ridicule by the Jews in the societies that they control, that they may destroy them and those institutions and the men who uphold them. Says Ramsey, 2 points in the above extract, that is the bit about Britain, France, and Russia being manipulated by Jews to destroy Hitler, are worthy of special note. First, it is taken for granted that these three Jews will not for one moment think or act as anything but Jews, and can be relied upon to guide their Gentile dupes to ruin, in a plainly Jewish war. So, Hoare, Belisha, and Bloom, and Litvinov don't for a second identify as Russians, Englishmen, and Frenchmen. They identify as Jews, and their agenda is what is good for Jews, and that includes duping Aryans and leading them into an anti-Aryan war that will serve Jewish interests. Secondly, says Ramsey, it should be noted that the contemptuous reference to the swastika de Christus, that would be Hitler as a sort of a Jesus of the Nazis, with his swastika, which Jewry looks forward to burying, and which reveals by its classification the Jewish hatred of Christianity, just as much as their hatred of Nazism, and their hatred of both of their symbols. Remember, Jews are supposed to spit when they cross a Christian church, or when they see a cross. Spit is what the Talmud tells them to do, and in Israel they literally spit on Christians to show their hatred of them. Meantime, Jewish pressure was exerted to the utmost to incite clashes between Sudeten Czechs, Poles, and Germans. By September of 1938, matters had reached a desperate pass. Mr. Chamberlain himself, and Ramsay knew Chamberlain, flew out to Munich and achieved the historic settlement with Hitler. And who is the hero, according to the neocons? It's Winston Churchill, because he did the Jews' bidding. And who is the bad guy? Why, it's Neville Chamberlain, because he tried to reach a peace with Hitler to avoid world war. Remember, Europe had just gone through a hugely destructive war in the 1910s, from 14 to 19, and now the Jews are attempting to incite another war, and Britain's not really prepared for that war. Germany has had onerous peace terms put upon it and is forced to pay back all kinds of money which it can't afford, and to starve itself in trying to do so. And Neville Chamberlain, a loyal Briton, is trying to prevent a war, and maybe he has read Mein Kampf or heard of it, or he's talked to Hitler directly, and he knows that Hitler has no intention of destroying the British Empire or bringing about a world war. He merely wants for Germany what belongs to Germany, which Germany had before the harsh peace of Versailles. And so Mr. Chamberlain himself flew out to Munich and achieved the historic settlement with Hitler. That's the one that's mocked today by the sellouts like Ann Coulter and the Fox News clowns like Sean Hannity and Rush Limbaugh, who do the work of the Jews enthusiastically and for very high pay, rather than maintaining their loyalty to their own people and looking out for what's good for Americans and Europeans and other branches of the Aryan race. It seemed as though, says Ramsey, the warmongers had been frustrated and Europe saved. Rarely had such scenes and evidences of spontaneous delight and thankfulness been evoked as were witnessed throughout Britain and Europe at that triumph. That is Neville Chamberlain coming back from Munich and waving the piece of paper with Hitler's signature. Those who knew the power of the enemy, however, knew that Mr. Chamberlain's work was certain to be swiftly sabotaged. I remember remarking on the very evening of his return from Munich that within a week, every newspaper in this country, that is in Britain, and the warmongers in Parliament, would be attacking Mr. Chamberlain for having secured peace, regardless of the fact that in doing so, they were contemptuously flouting the real wishes of the people. This remark was only too true, as events proved. Just as it is here in the U.S., those who counseled staying out of the Middle East today, just as they counseled yesterday staying out of the war in Europe, ended up being denounced as traitors and disloyalists because they're not willing to put Jewish interest, undeclared Jewish interest, ahead of real American interests. And now that the Jews have taken over American institutions, they can claim anyone opposed to them as an anti-American. Hence the need for the term, some term, which I, and the term I invented, Ameriquois, in order to distinguish America under the Jews from the real America that existed before and still exists in part and in hearts and minds after the Jewish takeover, which I would put in the mid-60s, although they did have and exercised considerable power before that time. There were so many things all at once that took place in the 60s, from gun control to removal of restrictions against race mixing and interracial marriage to feminism to open reversed immigration act to the assassination of John F. Kennedy, to the Civil Rights and the Voting Act and the according to Negroes of legal equality and the forced mixing with whites. All these things took place in the same time period, and together they amount to a successful, if comparatively bloodless, revolution in the U.S. And so Neville Chamberlain, seeking to represent true British interests in keeping Britain out of another war, a horribly destructive war with Germany after a war 20 years earlier had sacrificed the flower of British manhood, the fields of Flanders, steps off the plane waving a paper with Hitler's signature saying that he's found peace in our time, and he is to be mocked and attacked by the Jew-controlled politicians of Parliament who need a war with Germany in order to subdue Germany and get it back in the power of international Jews. And so Ramsay says, nowhere was the Jewish fury so obvious, of course, as in Moscow, where the Jews had carried out the first successful communist revolution in 1917. I have before me a leaflet of my own designing put out in October 1938. It runs, quote, "Are you aware that Mr. Chamberlain was burnt in effigy in Moscow as soon as it was known that he had secured peace? Showing very clearly who wanted war and who are still ceaselessly working to stir up strife all the world over." So the Jews are so brazen as to admit in their own internal publications, like Hebrew Week and what have you, in the papers published in Moscow after the Jewish takeover that formed the USSR, that they are as one worldwide, united in fomenting war against this nation which is broken free of their control and must be resubdued and smashed. The attempt to provoke war over Sudetenland, that is the German part of Czechoslovakia, and Czechoslovakia itself having failed, there remained only the detonator in the Polish corridor, that monstrosity born of the unholy Versailles Conference and denounced by honest men from Marshall Foch and Arthur Henderson from that time onwards. So after World War I, the Germans have German lands that are part of Germany taken away from them and given to Poland, but the people in these regions, of course, remain German, and they want to be united with Germany because they feel they're Germans and not Poles. One feature about the Versailles Conference has been kept secret by those who possess the power to keep things from the public. That would be the people who control the media, obviously, and the people who control the government and know the secrets, or to proclaim things from the housetops. It is this. All important decisions were taken by the Big Four, Britain, France, Italy, and the USA, at Versailles, represented respectively by Mr. Lloyd George, Mr. Clemenceau, Baron Sonnino, and President Wilson. So much is known. What is not known is that the secretary of Mr. Lloyd George, that is the British representative, was the Jew Sassoon, and the representative of the French guy, Clemenceau, the name that is circulated in the papers, is the Jew Mandel Rothschild, now known as Mandel. Baron Sonnino was himself half a Jew, and President Wilson had the Jew Brandeis. The interpreter was another Jew named Mantoux, I guess, M-A-N-T-O-U-X, and the military advisor, yet another Jew called Kish. So, in the newspapers, you read about the Big Four determining the fate of Germany and Europe after World War I at the Versailles Conference. But the representatives of all the famous names that are put in the paper are all Jews, and they are doing what is good for Jews. So always the hidden hand, just as the people you see on Fox TV who are describing American policy or advocating this or that, they are Jews, and the ones who go abroad to lie for America are Jews. And what they care about is what is good for Israel and the Jews, not what is good for America. So it is in 2008 as it was in 1938, 70 years earlier. It is known that Mr. Lloyd George and others were hazy about geography. Their Jewish secretaries, however, were on the contrary very much spot on in such matters. These Jews met at 6 p.m. in the evenings and mapped out the decision for the following day's conference of the Big Four. So white men who were willing to subcontract their thinking and even their self-defense, even their identification to the Jews, are going to wind up as passive consumers of mass sports who are butts bearing burdens in everything else. And the only way in which white masculinity is legal or respected is when the whites are joining the army and fighting for the Jews. Every other instance of white masculinity will be frowned on. Either you should join the military, or you should watch mass sports nonstop when you're not working, or you should be a homosexual. Those are the three options that the Jew has for the white man. Buy his products, fight his wars, or intermarry and die out. So, we have the Versailles Conference, we have the Big Four making the decisions, we have the public face of the Big Four, and then we have the representatives, or the insiders, or the secretaries. The people doing the real thinking and the real work are the Jews, and they are determining things to their own advantage. But it's not reported in the papers this way, of course. So the hidden key to understanding not only history, but today's newspaper, is the Jewish agenda. You have to know which of the parties involved is a Jew, or is represented by a Jew, or who has subcontracted his thinking to a Jew, in order to interpret the headlines in today's news. The results of the conference were disastrous from the point of view of all decent people, that is, average white people in Europe, who hope for an honorable treaty, with terms which, though they might be stringent, would at least be just and thereby secure lasting peace. Folk himself loudly denounced the treaty, declaring that it contained the certain makings of another war, and deprecating in particular the provision relating to Danzig and the corridor, the Polish corridor and the German city of Danzig, or the Polish city of Gdansk, it's called in Polish. Arthur Henderson and many public men joined in the denunciation, but all to no avail, because they're not the real powers. From the point of view of men planning another war, however, nothing could have been better than this treaty, the Versailles Treaty. All sorts of glaring injustices were ingrained in its text. In addition to the corridor and the position at Danzig, a bastard state was brought into being in which Germans, Slovaks, etc., together forming a majority of the country, were put under the tyrannical control of the Czech minority, an element which had thrown in its lot with the Bolshevik Jews and fought against the Allies in 1918. And we'll remember from the history that we related on earlier Radio Astina, the history of John Hus, as related by E. Michael Jones, is that this is one of the first places where a Catholic order was subverted by renegade priests and preachers and politicians who were going to bring back primitive Christianity by identifying with the church or with the Israelites of the Old Testament, and who identified with the Jewish radicals. And it's just interesting that apparently there's still an element of that 700 years later. And the Czechs are siding with the Bolsheviks in creating a mess out of Europe after the First World War. Go listen to an earlier Radio Astina if you want to hear about John Hus. 21, 22, 23, somewhere in there. Now let's see. My gosh, the time just flies by when we do these shows. I hope you're enjoying it as much as I do. And not even, it's not about enjoyment, though. It's really, it's necessary history. You're not going to get any of this history in the public school, nor are you going to get it in a public college, nor are you going to get it in a Catholic college. E. Michael Jones, who might relate some of this, was denied the chance to speak at a Catholic university by means of Jewish manipulations. I'll probably discuss that in another Radio Astina. So that even the things you what it comes down to is the Jews are so entrenched in power that you can't take any person or organization at face value. The fact that something claims to be Catholic doesn't mean that it's truly run by Catholics along Catholic lines. It might be run by Jews along Jewish lines, or by subverted or sellout Catholics in order to curry favor with the Jews. They might forbid a true Catholic from speaking. Just as Jews have created Nazi organizations or pseudo-white nationalists, I call them WINO, white in name only organizations, to serve to mislead Aryans who are apparently eternally gullible, even if they come to understand that the Republican Party does not truly represent white people. They might be fooled by an organization that claims it does, yet is led by someone who is either a Jew himself or someone who admits Jews under the false principle that they are no different from white men, even though all history shows that to be a big lie, and Jews themselves laugh at the idea. Don't take things at face value. So, Ramsey says, the design of this state containing Germans, Slovaks, under a Czech minority, was such geographically that it was styled, and correctly styled, as a dagger pointed at the heart of Germany, if you know the layout of Europe. It received the outlandish name of Czechoslovakia. The whole of industrial life, from the huge Skoda arsenal, that's one of the major arms works in Europe, is Skoda in Czechoslovakia, downward, was controlled by Jewish banking interests, that practically all the land was mortgaged to the Jews. And he cites someone in relation to that fact that he's asserting, that the land of the newly formed Czechoslovakia was mortgaged to the Jews. Hansard, October 1936. I don't know who that is. Under this messianic domination were enslaved huge sections of the populations belonging to other nations, henceforth condemned to be held down by force until some country should grow strong enough to champion them. So he's saying the Jews have manipulated the Versailles Conference in order to establish, one of their goals has been, and they've achieved it, to establish Czechoslovakia, in which Germans are held down, Slovaks are held down by Czechs, and the Czech lands are in hock to the Jews, so they're going to follow the Jewish policy. Same kind of stuff we saw in the Middle Ages, where Jews operated kind of between the king in Poland and the people, and they tried to do the same thing in Spain. And Christians aren't allowed to lend money. The Jews lend money. The Jews become rich. And the Jews lend that money then to the kings and the princes. And so the kings and princes need Jews to keep their power. The solution here is to get rid of Jews because they are fundamentally alien, parasitical, and hostile to our kind. They are trying to destroy our identity by decapitating us. They cut off the true head of the white people, the loyal, intelligent people like me, giving you these facts, and they replace it with some clown on TV who is nevertheless plausible to the Aryan dupes who take things at face value. Does Sean Hannity really speak for America? Does Rush Limbaugh really speak for America? Perhaps they do on one or two minor issues. But on the major issues of race and Jews and what's good for the country and its true history, no. They are sellouts, either knowingly or unwittingly. And the top ones are all quite witting. They know what they're doing. They've all been flown to Israel. They know that they've been bought. They know that if they were to go against the lie that Israel is our great friend and gallant little democratic ally, they would be cashiered. There wouldn't be any more TV or radio time for Pat Robertson or Jerry Falwell or Rush Limbaugh or Sean Hannity or Ann Coulter if she or he dared to stand up to the Jews and assert American or Aryan interests. They know that. They are sellouts. I am a loyalist. You listening to this are loyalists. You understand what's actually going on. It may not be popular, it may not make a lot of money, but it's right. Man does not live by bread alone. We have to be able to look at ourselves in the mirror and know that we were true while others were disloyal or were too dumb to see the truth. The first, there's not much we can do about. The second, we can clear up through spreading factual information and encouraging people to form local self-defense networks. Don't write anything down, but be ready and prepared to defend yourself. And the people you have to get rid of, the ones truly causing the problem, are not even the niggers or the Mexicans you rape and murder. They are merely the consequences of our elite having been subverted, bought out, infiltrated, and overthrown, even if kept in position visually for the benefit of the idiotic masses, by the Jews who are advancing their agenda over our dead bodies. That's the message of this Radio Astina and every Radio Astina. We are a people and we deserve to be free of the Jews, but no one can vindicate our rights except ourselves and our own brains and our own gunpowder. That's how it always is. That's the law of nature. So, Ramsey is describing the position of the Slovak and German minorities in Czechoslovakia, which is an artificial Jewish construct there to reap political and financial advantage for the Jews at the expense of the national aspirations and just reasonable everyday desires of the population and the people, who he describes as enslaved by this monstrous creation of Czechoslovakia. This eventuality was, in my opinion, says Ramsey, visualized and actually fostered as we know it by the huge loans to Germany from international banking interests. All prior, of course, to the rise of Hitler, he says. Let it not be forgotten that while Jewish bankers were pouring money into Germany, which was rebuilding the Wehrmacht on a bigger scale than ever, a colossal campaign for peace and disarmament was launched in this country, in Britain. This not only succeeded in substantially disarming us after World War I, but in creating an atmosphere in which Mr. Baldwin had to admit that he dared not go to the country asking for more armaments, vital though he knew our needs in sea, air, and land forces to be. So Britain had a very great percentage of its male population killed in World War I, you know, in which there was trench warfare, and we had the first real use of the machine gun to just mow people down. And so much so that, you know, many British women, I remember a story, gosh, I can't remember where it was from, but it was a story about women in school in Britain at the time, and the headmistress of the school said to them, a lot of you are simply never going to find a husband because the men you would have married are dead. And they're dead because the Jews inspired a world war in which
a far too high percentage of Europe's best men were turned into cannon fodder. They were fed in front of machine guns and machine gunned to death, and they would never reproduce. And this gravely weakened Europe. We put a lot of stress on the Second World War, but the First World War gravely weakened Europe, and it killed off the flower of the manhood. The best genes were not allowed to reproduce, leaving Europe even more open to the predations of the Jews, who were rising to power on the back of these new military as well as mass media technologies. To anyone, says Ramsay, who made a study of the personalities and powers behind this so-called peace propaganda in Britain, as I did, there can be no doubt as to whence the real drive and finance emanated. To anyone appreciating the attitude of the press at the time, and realizing that this disarmament propaganda that had this disarmament propaganda been distasteful to those who influence our publicity services, there would have blared forth a torrent of invective against our peace balloters, quote unquote. There is additional proof that this campaign had the support of international Jewry, as had the rearmament of Germany. But why, the simple will ask. And as always, the key to understanding the Achleff, or the skeleton key that opens all the doors, that which reconciles all apparently conflicting agendas, facts, and happenings, is the Jewish agenda. Once you know what world Jewry perceives to be good for Jews, then you have the key to understanding what actually goes on, because they are so situated as to be able to carry out their agenda almost across the board. The answer is fairly simple, says Ramsay, if once the purpose behind the Jewish plan is understood. Out of the last war, we brought the Soviet states of Russia. Out of the next war, we will bring the Soviet states of Europe. So what the Jews have done, remember, Lenin made a deal with the Germans in order to give the Germans a free hand in the West so that he could consolidate his Soviet revolution. The Judeo-Bolshevist revolution in Russia was worth preserving at all cost, and the very high cost that was demanded was that they stop fighting the Germans in the East and give the Germans a free hand, but the Germans then were crushed in the West. And so what the Jews have done through World War I is they've guaranteed the success of the USSR. Okay, we've got a revolution accomplished in one country, and we control not so overtly in the other countries, and we need to bring about a second world war in order to communize the rest of Europe. To make the next war possible, therefore, the seesaw must be balanced again. German strength must be built up, otherwise there can't be another war, and British strength whittled down after World War II. So, therefore, the Jews are pushing rearmament loans in Germany before Hitler during Weimar, and they're pushing peace in Britain after World War I. But they're reconciled by the sense that both of those are good for the Jews. They have to get the nations back to level before they can fight again. Then the Europeans can fight each other to the death of one and complete exhaustion of the other. A dramatic surprise is in store for both sides. Neither is to be the real winner. The real winner is quite a different army. Only the Jew won World War II. That's a little childhood ditty. Only the Jew won World War II. Only the Jew won World War II. This army is the one that will receive the real attention. For 25 years it will be built up under conditions of the greatest secrecy. Its leaders will not show their strength until the conflict is well underway. Not until a critical moment in the war will the European armies be permitted to guess at the existence of the huge factories beyond the Urals, or of the colossal proportions of the heavily mechanized hordes, which will then commence to roll westwards over Europe under the red flag of Marxism. So, while the Jews are propagandizing Western Europe over in Eastern Europe, in the Soviet Union, where they've consolidated their communism, they're building giant factories and mechanizing their weapons and militarizing the hordes of people they're going to need to roll westward in communized Europe. In March 1939, says Ramsay, a British guarantee to Poland was given by Mr. Chamberlain on the strength of a false report to the effect that a 48-hour ultimatum had been delivered by Germany to the Poles. This report subsequently turned out to be quite untrue. Again, March 1939, Chamberlain is giving Poland guarantees on the basis of false report. The guarantee had been given, however, and the decision of peace or war was now no longer in British hands. Jewry had the ball at its feet, to use a soccer metaphor. Can we doubt but that Poland was encouraged to ignore the German note of March, which set forth eminently reasonable suggestions for a peaceful solution of the problem of the corridor? This is political territory that the Germans want for Germany because it's always been Germany, but it was seized from Germany after World War I, and the Jewish manipulators who did the thinking and the laying out have given this territory to Poland precisely so that it will become a bone of contention that can result in a Second World War that will secure all of Europe for communism and for Jewry. Month after month, no reply was vouchsafed by Poland to the German note. Meanwhile, insult and outrage occurred with suspicious frequency all along the German frontier, similar to the technique to which Jews later introduced the British in Palestine. Day after day, the British public was deluged with war propaganda and misrepresentation of the situation, just as we are today with regard to Iran, just as we were a few years ago with regard to Iraq. The Jews who control the media and who buy our politicians control them by blackmail or by lobbying and the money that lobbying affords these pals, which they need to run, money being the mother's milk of politics, just as they do that today in America. America today, in order to get us into wars, they did yesterday in Europe, in Britain, in France, in Germany. Finally, their minds were closed against any further regard to the demands of justice or reason by a new slogan invented by the Jews. You cannot trust Hitler's word, say the people who have always been known by our best men as congenital liars. Jews have always been known by Aryans as congenital liars and the common enemy of all mankind. That's what our people have been saying about Jews for 2,000 years. And that's why I say, the man who puts an end to the Jews, who exterminates them, who liberates Aryan kind from the Jews, will go down in history as the greatest man ever. That's the plum to be sought. There is no greater possible artistic or political achievement than liberating Aryan kind from the Jews. And when I say these extreme sports fanatics, these kids who are able to do incredible loops, spins, and 360 times three on their skateboards and their snowboards and their BMX bikes, I can't help but think that that same genius applied to politics can produce the result that we need. So let there be a new extreme sport developed, white self-defense and white liberation, the liberation of Aryan kind from the Jew. This slogan, "You cannot trust Hitler's word," was founded upon a misrepresentation of Hitler's assurance given on more than one occasion after a putsch such as that into the Sudetenland that he, quote, intended to make no further demands. The misrepresentation lay in the fact that the press steadily obscured the major fact that the demands to which Hitler referred were all along fivefold in character, and covered those five areas taken from the Germans by a dictated peace in which the population was overwhelmingly German, i.e. Sudetenland, the German part of Czechoslovakia, parts of Poland, the corridor, and Danzig. So what parallel do we see between their misrepresentation of what Hitler said yesterday, today? Well, obviously we see the misrepresentation of what Ahmadinejad said about Israel. Jewish liar said that he wanted to wipe out Israel, when in fact he said that at some point Israel would disappear from the pages of time. Jews knowingly mischaracterized, misrepresented what a world leader said. They were opposed to him, therefore they placed lies in his mouth. That's how Jews operate, and they will continue to operate that way as long as they live and as long as that technique is successful. So you can't believe anything that a Jew says. Everything a Jew says must be verified, and the proper assumption is that the Jew is lying to serve his Jewish agenda. Until you have disproven that, nothing a Jew says can be believed. As German troops occupied each successive section, that is, the five areas that Hitler wanted returned to Germany, it is, I believe, accurate to say that Hitler declared that he had no additional demands to make, but here it must be clearly stated in the interest of justice that he never said that this entailed reducing the demands which he had originally very clearly delineated and repeated on many occasions, namely the five areas in question. The British public was deluded by its press into supposing that when Hitler said he had no further demands, that there had never been any statement of his full demands, some of which were still unfulfilled. They were led to believe that Hitler either never had had other demands, or that he had abandoned the rest as soon as he had obtained some of them. So Hitler said very clearly what he wanted and intended, but it was lied about by the Jews operating the British press, and this fooled the bulk of the British people, just as the Jews' lies from Fox News and from MSNBC and from CNN fool the American people today. Although, thanks to an internet, probably a larger percentage of our population has some idea that the vague thing known as government is lying to them, as witnessed by, you know, most polls find that about a third to 40% of the public doesn't accept the official big lie as regards the World Trade Center demolitions. When, therefore, the next installment was added, and the press built on this misunderstanding, the fallacy that Hitler's word could not be trusted, honest dealing needs no such trickery and deception, says Ramsey. Such methods are only necessary to bolster up bad or unjust causes. That is, the Jew is lying because his honest agenda can't withstand scrutiny, because it runs counter to the interests of the people he lives among. And that can't be admitted honestly because the Jew is a minority. The minority that is pressing interests against the interests of the majority can't speak its name openly or advance its agenda openly. It has to lie and misrepresent it, whether in Britain or in the U.S. or anywhere else. Fortunately, says Ramsey, we have the calm and dispassionate judgment in this matter by no less a person than the late Lord Lothian, Lothian, recently British ambassador to the United States of America. In his last speech at Chatham House on this subject, he remarked, quote, if the principle of self-determination had been applied in Germany's favor, as it was applied against her, it would have meant the return of Sudetenland, Czechoslovakia, parts of Poland, the Polish corridor, and Danzig to the Reich, unquote. So the British ambassador to the U.S. is admitting that Hitler is correct in demanding that these portions of Germany be returned to Germany, which were unjustly stolen from her after World War I. Here is a very different presentment of the case to the one which was foisted upon the British public in 1939, and it is the true one, says Ramsey, of the ambassador's words. Small wonder that these facts had to be withheld from the ordinary citizen. We have to lie to the citizens in order to get them, to co-opt them into our war for Israel. Had the British public realized the truth, that each of these demands of Hitler's rested on a foundation of reasonable fairness, the people of this island would have ruled out any question of war. And it was war, not truth or justice, upon which international Jewry was resolved, says Ramsey, thereby concluding Chapter 6 on the Jews making war on Hitler. Now we'll proceed to Chapter 7. I don't know if we're going to be able to get all the way through the rest of this as I thought. I've taken a little time to make some divagations and excursions here, but we'll keep going. 7, phony war ended by civilian bombing. Though a state of war was declared to exist between Britain and Germany in September of 1939, it very soon became apparent that no war was being conducted by Germany against this country, that is, against Britain. This was no surprise to those who knew the facts of the case. Hitler had again and again made it clear, as we discussed in an earlier Radio Astina, talking about the earlier chapters of this book before Chapter 6, Hitler had again and again made it clear that he never intended to attack or harm Great Britain or the British Empire. With the Siegfried Line strongly held, and no German intention of appearing west of it, stalemate in the West, or the quote-unquote phony war, as it came to be called, must, in the absence of bombing of civilian populations, ultimately peter out altogether. No one was quicker to perceive this than the pro-Jewish warmongers, and they and their friends inside and outside the House of Commons very soon began exerting pressure for this form of bombing of Germany to be started. So, Hitler's not going to attack Britain or try to destroy its empire. The Jews know this. Hitler knows this. Loyalists in Britain know this, but the public doesn't know this. They're deluded in this. And to get the war going, to replace the phony war with a real war, the Jews are going to agitate through their frontmen like Churchill the civilian bombing of Germany. Not only advocate it, they're going to be the first to begin it, to start it. And then when Hitler responds, they will have the backing they need to keep going with their campaign of lies about how he intends to destroy Britain and her empire. On 14th January 1940, the Sunday Times gave prominence to a letter from an anonymous correspondent who demanded to know why we were not using our air power, quote, to increase the effect of the blockade, unquote. Scrutator, in the same issue, commented on this letter as follows, quote, such an extension of the offensive would inevitably develop into competitive frightfulness. It might be forced on us in reprisals for enemy action, and we must be in a position to make reprisals if necessary, but the bombing of industrial towns, with its unavoidable loss of life among the civilian populations, that is what it would come to, would be inconsistent with the spirit, if not the actual words, of the pledges given from both sides at the beginning of the war. So British loyalists are saying, well, if Germany were to go ahead and bomb Britain, then yes, we'd have to respond, but we shouldn't initiate it ourselves or it will result in frightfulness on both sides. But of course, the Jews want war because it's not their populations who are going to be killed. It's the stupid Aryan suckers. They need to fight their wars. The above quotation is taken from a book entitled Bombing Vindicated, which was published in 1944 by Mr. J.M. Speight, S-P-A-I-G-H-T, who was the principal assistant secretary at the Air Ministry during the war. As its title suggests, this book is an attempt to justify the indiscriminate use of bombers against the civil population. What do we see going on today in Iraq for 10 years, and they'd like to do in Iran, is bombing from the air, bombing, reducing these towns to rubble, killing tens, hundreds, thousands, hundreds of thousands, ultimately millions of civilians, because after all, they're not Jews. Non-Jewish lives don't matter to Jews. They're expendable. If the Jews need to reorder the Middle East today, then just as they had to reorder Europe yesterday, bombing civilians is an important part of that. It's an integral tool. In it, Mr. Speight boasts that this form of bombing, this indiscriminate bombing of civilians, quote-unquote, saved civilization, just as our indiscriminate bombing at Jewish behest brought democracy to Iraq today. It saved civilization yesterday by destroying a common enemy of humanity, the Germans, when in fact the enemy of humanity is the Jews. The pushers of the war are the Jews. The media liars are the Jews. The bad guys, in short, are the Jews. And Speight reveals that the startling fact that it was Britain that started this ruthless form of war. Britain started the indiscriminate bombing of civilian populations, not Germany. The Nazis didn't begin it. Britain began it. Britain began it under the behest and control of the Jews, because the Jews needed Britain to destroy Germany, along with America and the Russia they already controlled overtly, rather than covertly, as was the case in the Western republics. It was Britain that started this ruthless form of war on the very evening of the day on which Mr. Churchill became Prime Minister, May 11th, 1940. So, Churchill takes over in May of 1940, 5 or 6 months after the war has begun in late 1939, and yet it's a phony war in the West because the Germans aren't really trying to destroy France or Britain, or let alone Britain's empire. The Germans' war aims lie in the East, where they want to recover their territory. But Churchill, a tool of the Jews, as soon as he becomes, the very evening of the day he becomes Prime Minister, initiates the civilian bombing of German populations. And that was May 11th, 1940. On page 64 of his book, Mr. Speight gives a further piece of information which renders this sudden change of British policy all the more astonishing. For he states that a declaration was made by the British and French governments on 2nd September 1939 that, quote, only strictly military objectives in the narrowest sense of the word would be bombarded. So, in September of 1939, when the war began, Britain declared that only military objectives would be bombed. But when Churchill takes power in, you know, October, November, December, January, February, March, April, May, about 8 months later, when Churchill takes power, the very day he takes office, they start bombing German civilian centers against their declared doctrine. What can reconcile this apparent conflict? Why? It's good for the Jews. Knowledge of the Jewish agenda reconciles all competing arguments or claims, or apparent discrepancies in the words and actions of men. This declaration, of course, was made in the days of Mr. Chamberlain's premiership. Chamberlain in 39 is saying, we're only going to bomb military objectives, and they and the Germans agreed to that. And no single fact, perhaps, could demarcate and differentiate more clearly the difference in the character and behavior between Mr. Chamberlain and Mr. Churchill. Who do these neocons like Ann Coulter like today? John McCain, bomb, 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 Moran. They're on the side of Churchill. They want to bomb civilian populations. They don't care about military objectives. They just want to bomb and terrorize the people in the war of in the name of an international war on terror that is really an international war to secure and extend Jewry and Big Jew and what's good for the Jews. So these bloodthirsty warmongers are on the side of the Jews. The side of peace and justice is the side of the Nazis and the loyalists like Neville Chamberlain and the honest men like Captain Ramsay. They and we are the good guys. The Jews and the sellouts and their appeasers like Ann Coulter are the bad guys. They bring war, blood, and misery to the world. We bring the good things. On the 27th of January 1940, 13 days after the letter in the Sunday Times quoted, I already quoted, the Daily Mail endorsed editorially the views which had been expressed in that issue by Scrutator, S-C-R-U-T-A-T-O-R, and it devoted a leading article, writes Mr. Speight, to combating the decision or the suggestion of Mr. Amory and others that we should start the bombing of Germany. Sir Duff Cooper had written on the previous day in the same paper that, quote, there would appear to exist a kind of unwritten truce between the two belligerents, according to the tacit terms of which they do not bomb one another. So, they're saying there's a tacit truce between Germany and Britain that, look, if it comes to it, we'll bomb military objectives, but we're not going to start this by bombing civilian populations. Remember, the airplane has only been around for, you know, 20 years, and it hasn't really been developed all that much until this point. So this is kind of a new thing in the annals of warfare that can be used to browbeat and harass populations as well as military objectives. In view of the declaration by Britain and France of September 2, 1939, that they would only bomb military objectives in the narrowest sense of the word, quote-unquote, that quote is from, quote, only bomb military objectives in the narrowest sense of the word, unquote, Sir Duff Cooper's verbiage about, quote, a kind of unwritten truce, unquote, seems to me gravely obscurantist, if honest. Inside the House of Commons, the pro-Jewish warmongers were now becoming more and more intransigent. more and more set on sabotaging the chances of turning the phony war, quote-unquote, into a negotiated peace. This in spite of the fact that Britain had nothing to gain by further and total war, and everything to lose. As indeed it did lose, it lost its empire, which Hitler never wanted to destroy. The British Empire was destroyed by the politicians who ate toads for Israel, Winston Churchill, and for that reason he is marked down as the man of the millennium, the greatest man of the last 1,000 years, because he toadied for the Jews, even though it was against the interests of his own people and might well have set them on the road to destroying themselves, as we see now that you can no longer defend yourself with a gun nor speak freely in Britain, and indeed if you try to speak freely you'll be cast into prison in the former colony even of Britain, America. The Jews, let me repeat, of course, had everything to lose by a peace which left the German gold-free money system and Jew-free government intact and nothing to gain. So Germany has not only removed political control from the Jews and restored it to the Germans, it has removed Germany from the international money system. And these are horrifyingly threatening to the Jews because as an alien parasite, they need control of these mechanisms to keep themselves rich and the stupid, dirty goyim, the filthy, dirty, unclean beast, cattle, who aren't sensitive and delicate like the wonderful, refined Jews, in their place. They have to control our money, they have to control our men, they have to control our media in order to keep control over us, keep us doing and thinking the way that they want it, the way that works for them, keep us, you know, looking at internet porn and beating off and watching sports and doing this and that. That's what we're supposed to be doing, rather than taking our men in opposing, ending them as a threat to our kind and our way of life for all times. And merely segregating from them from us won't do. We've done that many times. We've swept them out of our lands. It has never worked. They have always returned. They've always been able to bribe and sneak their way back into our countries and retake control. They must be ended for all time as a threat, and the way to do that is by exterminating them, since they cannot and will not live by themselves alone and leave other people alone. They must be done away with. So, true British interests were represented by Chamberlain and by the people who said, if there must be a war, we're not going to bomb civilian populations. We recognize that Hitler, man to man and in his book, has said that he has no mission to end the British Empire or take over Britain. He admires our country, he admires our empire, just as he admires the Catholic Church and the traditional social order. He doesn't want to destroy those. Therefore, our true interest is in seeing that he doesn't, you know, he whatever he does in the East is his own business. It's not our business. So these people are at war inside the House of Commons with the Jew shills, the Jew appeasers, the Jew toadies, those who eat toads for the Jews, like Winston Churchill, who are set to bring Britain into this war and don't care that it will eventually cost Britain all of her colonies, her prestige, and ultimately her island itself. It seemed clear to me every day that this struggle over the question of civilian bombing was the crux of the whole matter, and that by this method of warfare alone could the Jews and their allies cut the Gordian knot of stalemate leading to peace, and probably later on to a joint attack on Jewish Bolshevism in Russia. So the Jews are afraid that if Britain stays out of the war, Germany will end up destroying the Soviet Union, in which they've consolidated their communist revolution and completed their takeover of the dirty, swinish, goyish multitudes and the half-Asiatic hordes. They don't want that destroyed. Rather, they want that system spread over the rest of Europe and eventually around the world. Accordingly, on 15th February 1940, I put down the following question to the Prime Minister. Captain Ramsay asked the Prime Minister whether, quote, whether he will assure the House that Her Majesty's government will not assent to the suggestions made to them to abandon those principles which led them to denounce the bombing of the civilian populations in Spain and elsewhere and embark upon such a policy themselves. Unquote. Mr. Chamberlain himself replied in outspoken terms, quote, I am unaware of the suggestions to which my honorable and gallant friend refers. The policy of Her Majesty's government in this matter was fully stated by myself in answer to a question by the honorable member for Bishop Auckland, Mr. Dalton, on 14th September last. In the course of that answer, I said that whatever be the length to which others may go, Her Majesty's government will never resort to the deliberate attack on women and children and other civilians for purposes of mere terrorism. I have nothing to add to that answer. Unquote. So all these claimed Christians, but in reality Jew appeasers, sellouts, and self-promoters of the highest order that you see on Fox News, they are on the side of the bloodthirsty warmongers, and their bloodthirstiness doesn't even serve an American agenda, it serves a Jewish agenda, and they know this and willingly go along with it, and that is the way the world works. Most people are sellouts. Most people, if offered, will sell out. And that is why the nation as a whole, because a team of people who are intelligent and who work together and who have long practice in deception, chicanery, crime, and warmongering are able to run rampant over goys who are operating as individuals and who don't see any similarly powerful team to which they can attach themselves. So they figure, well, I might as well sell out. If you can't beat them, join them. And that's what they do. And those are the people you see hectoring, lecturing to you, and denouncing anybody who stands against the extension of war on Israel's enemies, but who in name is really a true American. They denounce them as what they themselves are, appeasers and sellouts. And this fools the mass of the people because they don't have the time or the sophistication to understand the game being played on them. So after Ramsey asks his question and Chamberlain answers it saying, no, we're going to stick to what we said. We're not going to bomb civilian populations. He says, both my question and the reply to it were evidently distasteful in the extreme to the warmongers, the British equivalents of Ann Coulter and Sean Hannity. So I resolved to carry the matter to a stage further. On 21st September, or 21st February, I put down another question on the subject. Captain Ramsey asked the Prime Minister, quote, whether he is aware that the Soviet aeroplanes are carrying on a campaign of bombing civil populations, and whether Her Majesty's government have dispatched protests on the subject similar to those dispatched during the Civil War in Spain in similar circumstances. So, the Jewish warmongers and the appeasers and sellouts in Britain want to begin as soon as possible the bombing of civil populations in Germany in order to bring Germany into a real war against Britain rather than a paper war. And in countries already controlled by Jewish revolutionaries, such as the Soviet Union, they already are bombing civil populations. And Ramsey, who is a member of parliament himself, is asking the leader of the country, Neville Chamberlain, to clarify and ask him whether he is going to bomb civil populations himself, to which he says no, and if so, why he hasn't denounced the Soviet Union for doing that thing. Mr. Butler replied for the Prime Minister, yes, sir, the Soviet air forces have pursued a policy of indiscriminate bombing which cannot be too strongly condemned. Her Majesty's government have not, however, lodged any protest, since there are, unfortunately, no grounds for supposing that such action would achieve the desired result. Unquote. There can be, says Ramsey, little doubt but that these two downright answers crystallize the resolves of the warmongers to get rid of a prime minister whose adherence to an upright and humane policy must inevitably frustrate their plans, seeing that Hitler wished no war with Britain and would therefore never start civilian bombing himself. So, again, the reason that I'm taking the time to read this to you and interpret it for you is that you will never get this in the public school. and to reinforce the strong analogy between what the Jews were doing in Britain and Western Europe and America yesterday in relation to Germany, which had broken free of them, in relation to what they're doing today with regard to Iraq and Iran. Same Jews, same motives, same agenda played out and carried out upon the backs and bodies of the same suckers, you and I, who are being manipulated and lied to and even paid occasionally to carry out a Jewish agenda that in the end will do nothing but destroy not only our own nations, but our entire kind of people. If we pursue our appeasement of the Jews and our warmongering on their behalf far enough, we will find it destroys not only our colonies and our countries, but our entire kind. We must liberate our kind from the Jew. And that liberation begins in the mind, with our understanding of the ways in which we are manipulated, and the reasons we are manipulated, and the group these manipulations serve. And that's the point of this show, is to teach you that, if you don't know it already. The machinery of intrigue and rebellion against Mr. Chamberlain was set in motion. Ultimately, he was saddled with the blame for the Norway blunder, and this pretext was used by the Churchillian come socialist caucus to secure Chamberlain's downfall. That is, they used their failure to occupy Norway before the Germans as a way to bring down Chamberlain and install Churchill as a British front for the Jewish warmongers. And the minute Churchill got in office, he started bombing the Germans, which they had to respond to after a time, although they didn't respond for a while. It should be remembered in this connection, being a more civilized people than the British, having a higher percentage of Germans who understood the Jews and were willing to stand up to them than the British did, Britain long having been bought by Jewish money, long before Germany was, back to the time of 1290 when they let the British back into the... The Jews were banned from Britain in 1290, but they were readmitted under Cromwell, whom the Jews put up the money to get into power in return for his readmitting them to the British Empire, even though the law that forbid them was never formally changed. It should be remembered in this connection that prior to and during the Norway gamble, Mr. Churchill had been invested with full powers and responsibilities for all naval, military, and air operations, and if anyone therefore deserved to be broken over that second Gallipoli being a famous failure of Churchill in the First World War, pursued in defiance of high naval authority, warning that without control of the Kattegat and Skagerrak it could not possibly succeed, it should have been the minister responsible. That is, Churchill was the one responsible for the Germans occupying Norway before Britain could, just as he was responsible for the failure in Turkey in World War I when he went against all advice and got a lot of people killed. He, however, was not only unbroken, he was acclaimed prime minister. The man who would tear up the British pledge of September 2, 1939 and start bombing the civilians of Germany was the man for the warmongers who now ruled the roost. So he put a British face on Jewish policy, because the Jews, Jewish moneybags, had bailed him out of debt. Churchill never had any particular principles other than himself being in power, and he flipped from one party to the other, and he was responsible for a number of military catastrophes, and he was deep in debt and about to lose his house or his mansion or his estate, when Strakosch, an Austrian, possibly a Jew, certainly an Austrian, and other people bailed him out in exchange for his representing them and their warmongering. And so, says Ramsey, civilian bombing started on the evening that the architect of the Norwegian fiasco became prime minister, May 11th, 1940. And that wraps up chapter 7. What we see is that after World War I, there's a peace conference at Versailles, and the men who do the real thinking and lawyering and representing are not the ones portrayed in the paper, but they're the Jews. A Jew in each of the big four countries, they create a situation which they can use to manipulate to bring about a second world war that will further consolidate their international communist revolution that's now established in Russia alone, as large as that country is. And this meant different things in different places. It meant rearming Germany. At the same time, it meant disarming Britain. Through propaganda in the various nations, they carried this on. And finally, by demonizing a man who stood for true British interests, Neville Chamberlain, who understood what Hitler was about and what Hitler wanted and saw that his demands were rational and thought he had achieved peace in our time, they had to go on and demonize him in order to get their own kind into power. And their own kind being bloodthirsty warmongers who didn't care about Britain but would merely further Jewish aims and would bring about a true world war by initiating civilian bombing of Germany, which the Germans would have to eventually respond to. And that's what the Jews did. And that's why Neville Chamberlain goes down as an appeaser and a loser and an evil man, whereas Churchill goes down as the man of the millennium, even though Churchill destroyed the British Empire and set in motion the destruction of the island itself. Because if you're carrying out Jewish aims, one of their aims is that was established by World War II was that Hitler and the evil Nazis were racist, this new word that Jewish ideologues, Jewish communists had coined and used to browbeat whites. Any white who wanted to preserve his own land, his own people, his own extended family that is called the nation was a racist according to the terms used by Jewish ideologues, Jewish communists, and something evil, morally evil, politically unsupportable. And so anti-racist policies that were pushed by the Jews eventually came to be law across the West, and this resulted in the destruction of the people themselves in Germany, France, Britain, as well as the United States of America. We talked about the reversal of the immigration policy. So what we've done today is discuss the roots of this in World War II. And let's do one more chapter. It's a very brief one just on Dunkirk. And then we'll wrap it up for today. And we will not have gotten through the end of the book, as I said we would at the start. But I think 3 hours is enough to go for one show today. And we will conclude the rest of it next time. We'll do 9 to 12 and the epilogue, but we'll just do one more little chapter here on Dunkirk, a couple of pages to continue the story. So what we've seen is Neville Chamberlain represented Britain's true interest. Churchill represented the Jews. Chamberlain, after appearing to preserve peace, not least through understanding that Hitler had 5 rational demands for space to be returned to Germany under the principle of self-determination, ostensibly celebrated by all sides after World War I, but that he and Hitler, Britain and Germany, agreed not to bomb each other's civil populations, and Germany kept up its side of this tacit or explicit agreement. But the Jews, operating in the House of Commons, had a different agenda, and they needed to bring Britain into the war. And so their figurehead, Churchill, had to be brought into power. And the very minute he was brought into power, he initiated civil population bombing against the understanding that the Germans and the British had, and turning the war into a true world global war. Now, Chapter 8, Dunkirk and After. Captain Liddell Hart, the eminent military critic, wrote a book on the military events of 1939 to 1945, which was published in 1948 and entitled The Other Side of the Hill. Chapter 10, which deals with the German invasion of France, down to and including Dunkirk, bears the somewhat startling title, How Hitler Beat France and Saved Britain, unquote. The reading of the chapter itself will astound all propaganda-blinded people, even more than the title, for the author therein proves that not only did Hitler save this country, but that this was not the result of some unforeseen factor, or indecision, or folly, but was of set purpose, based on his long enunciated, in Mein Kampf, and faithfully maintained principle, i.e. that he was not out to destroy Britain and take it over, or to destroy the British Empire, despite the lies of the Jews and the media. Having given details of how Hitler peremptorily halted the Panzer Corps on the 22nd of May, remember, Churchill has just taken power on 11th of May and initiated civil bombing of German civilians. On 22nd May, Hitler halts the panzers and kept them inactive for the vital few days till, in fact, the British troops had got away from Dunkirk. So Hitler allowed the British to escape from France at Dunkirk and go back to Britain. Captain Liddell Hart quotes Hitler's telegram to von Kleist, quote, "The armored divisions are to remain at medium artillery range from Dunkirk. Permission is only granted for reconnaissance and protective movements," unquote. Von Kleist decided to ignore the order, the author tells us. To quote him again, "Then came a more emphatic order that I was to withdraw behind the canal. My tanks were kept halted there for 3 days," unquote. So what is presented in the West as the miracle of Dunkirk, by which the British save themselves, is actually the decision taken by Hitler to allow them to save their best military men at Dunkirk. In the following words, the author reports a conversation which took place on May 24th, 2 days later, that is, between Herr Hitler and Marshal von Rundstedt, and two key men of his staff. Quote, "He then astonished us by speaking with admiration of the British Empire, of the necessity for its existence, and of the civilization that Britain had brought into the world. He compared the British Empire with the Catholic Church, saying they were both essential elements of stability in the world. He said that all he wanted from Britain was that she should acknowledge Germany's position on the continent. The return of Germany's lost colonies would be desirable, but not essential. And he would even offer to support Britain with troops if she should be involved in any difficulties anywhere. He concluded by saying that his aim was to make peace with Britain on a basis that she would regard compatible with her honor to accept." So again, multiple people outside of Hitler are saying the same thing that Ramsay is saying about Hitler. He had no designs on Britain or her empire, nor did he have designs on the Catholic Church. But the Jews had designs on both, even if the design were only insofar as they are willing to use any goyish institution or man to further their ends and then discard him without a moment's notice, or destroy him as the case may be. And to do this, they have to misrepresent history. They have to misrepresent Hitler and his true aims, which it is our purpose to disobscure here, that is, to clarify through the use of these fine works written by honorable men like Captain Ramsay. That's what we're actually doing here, giving you true history. Captain Liddell Hart comments on the above as follows, quote, "If the British army had been captured at Dunkirk, the British people might have felt that their honor had suffered a stain which they must wipe out. By letting it escape, Hitler hoped to conciliate them," unquote. "This conviction of Hitler's deeper motive," he continues, "was confirmed by his strangely dilatory attitude over the subsequent plans for the invasion of England." That is, he didn't really want to invade there, and he ended up not doing it at all, and it cost him the war eventually, because he might not have understood that, as noble as he might have felt Britain and her empire to be, Britain were controlled by Jews, who were using it, through Churchill, to advance their own agenda. And that might have, looking back on it, through 2020 hindsight, have necessitated the destruction, however painful it would have been, of the British army at Dunkirk, that they could not be there to be used by these Jews to destroy Germany and consolidate Judeo-Bolshevism's hold over the entire world. says Liddell Hart. Hitler showed little interest in the plans, Blumentritt said, and made no effort to speed up the preparation. That was utterly different to his usual behavior. Before the invasion of Poland, of France, and later of Russia, he repeatedly spurred them on. But on this occasion, he sat back. The author continues, since the account of his conversation at Charleville and subsequent holding back comes from a section of the generals who had long distrusted Hitler's policy, that makes their testimony all the more notable. So these generals that were opposed to Hitler, I guess von Rundstedt and the others, they recognize that if you allow this army to escape, it can come back to haunt you, as it in fact did. Significantly, he goes on to say, their account of Hitler's thoughts about England at the decisive hour before Dunkirk fits in with much that he himself wrote earlier in Mein Kampf, and it is remarkable how closely he followed his own Bible in other respects, unquote. Says Ramsey, anyone who has read Mein Kampf will immediately appreciate the accuracy of that above statement, the above statement. It is indeed, if anything, an understatement. Throughout that remarkable book run two main themes, as I have shown in an earlier chapter. The one, a detailed delineation and denunciation of the Jewish capitalist revolutionary machine, the other, admiration for and eagerness for friendship with Britain and the Empire. It is a pity indeed that so few persons in this island have read the book for themselves, and it is a tragedy that they have swallowed instead wholesale the unscrupulous distortions and untrue propaganda on the subject served up to them by the Jewish publicity machinery operating through our press and radio. Let these people but try and obtain a copy of that book, and when they cannot find they cannot, let them reflect that if indeed its contents confirm the lies that have been told about it and its author, the powers behind our publicity would ensure that everyone should be able to secure a copy at the cheapest possible rate. So the Jews circulate material that helps them, and they suppress material that hurts them. They lie about the material. They lie about what Hitler said in Mein Kampf and what he said about the Jews and British Empire. In any event, says Ramsey, I would urge my countrymen, the British, to ponder most earnestly the following facts. The Jew Karl Marx laid it down that Bolshevism could never really succeed till the British Empire had been utterly destroyed. Karl Marx, the Jew, said that Bolshevism could never really succeed till the British Empire was destroyed. Hitler laid it down that the British Empire was an essential element of stability in the world, and even declared himself ready to defend it with troops if it should be involved in difficulties anywhere. By unscrupulous propaganda on an unprecedented scale, this country was led into destroying those who wished to be her friends and who offered their lives to defend her, and exalting those who proclaimed that her destruction was a necessary preliminary to the success of their ideology, forfeiting her empire and her economic independence in the process. So, Britain, taken over by Jews, destroyed itself by attacking its true friends, Hitler and the nationalist Germans, and lost its empire in the process. And then, as an extension of that, was forced to adopt anti-racist, i.e., code for anti-white, policies, which in time would result in the destruction of Britain herself, through the transformation of a racial stock into a melange of third world mud. And the same thing, mutatis mutandis, is taking place across the Western world. Always Jews are fomenting and pushing the same revolutions and policies. Friends, that's the end of our story for today. And I think it's pretty pretty telling and cautionary tale that we've been told and taught by Ramsey in the Nameless War. We covered today in Radio Astina number 20. I think we're on 26 or 27. I should know, but I don't offhand. Doesn't matter the number. We've done chapters 7 and 8 today. And we've seen the truth about the way the Jews manipulated Britain to serve their ends, and Europe in the larger sense to serve their ends, from the end of World War I up through Dunkirk in World War II. And we related our lessons to what we see going on around us today. And again, the ultimate lesson of this Radio Astina show and all the shows that we do is that you understand that you belong to a unique race of people, uniquely created, creative, and cultured, and that your race is under attack by the same Jews today who created and fomented these world wars and these revolutions yesterday. And that until we liberate ourselves from the Jew, we will never be able to live the way we like among our own kind of people. With that, I'm Alex Linder, signing off Radio Astina, and I'll be back with you again next Tuesday at 1 p.m. Central. Thank you for listening. Goodbye.